Before we get too far into this podcast, thanks to the folks at Racetech, racetech.com. Tell them you listen to Pulp MX, Steve Mathis Show. They will give you a deal on suspension work, on motor work, whatever it is. They got it going on. Get the right springs in your bike for your weight and or speed. Racetech.com. Privateer proven. Thank you to Racetech. All right, on to the show.
A Pulp MX Network production.
Welcome to the Fly Racing Steve Mathis Show, presented by Maxxis Tires, Renthal, and Motorsport.com on RacerXOnline.com. With your continuing gracious support of our sponsors, we're thriving at over 1,800 podcasts delivered with over 20 million downloads. Click the Amazon banner on Pulp MX to help us out. Donate via Patreon if it suits you. And as always, enrich your moto lifestyle by working with the sponsors who support us. The original Moto Podcast, featuring legends of the past, stars of today, season previews, race reviews, introspection, opinion, facts, and laughs. Here's the voice bringing it all to you, Steve Mathis.
Say that dedication to your frustration. Is it really some of the planets in giving it all?
Welcome, everybody, to the Fly Racing Racer X podcast. Chris Johnham, Johnham Media. Really interesting career in the sport, moto and, well, I should say on and off road. And now in responsible, one of the jobs responsible for the Honda Supercross Motocross team PR. So we'll talk to him about access to the riders now, the media nowadays, and get into his own personal journey. Thanks for listening, man. Appreciate it. FlyRacing.com. 2026 gear is out. The code PULPAMEX saves you at FlyRacing.com across the board. So whether it's the great Formula helmet, Formula S, they got the Formula CC, different shells, whether it's the Evo gear, off-road gear, women's gear, kids gear, 2026 designs are out. Some of the stuff looks great. And yeah, head to toe, Fly's got you covered. Cooper Webb, of course, winning the championship. And the Koonin brothers doing really well. Langefelder leading MX2. Fly Racing, man, a lot of racing success for those guys in 2025, more than they've ever had, I would say. So use the code and save. Great stuff. And Maxxis, Motorsport, Brunt Workwear, all on board with us. We'll tell you more about them later on in the show. And thank you to the folks at Renthal, Factory Honda, speaking of them, using Renthal products, fat bars, 7/8 bar, twin wall bars, all of it available, Renthal.com, KTM, Kawasaki as well. And lots of things at Renthal that you know about, and lots of things that are coming. Really exciting mountain bike product coming soon from the folks at Renthal, Renthal.com. And the lock-on grips crushing it, by the way. If you're a fan of lock-on grips, you got to get the Renthal one. All the different patterns, all the different compounds available. And it's the first and only lock-on grip that no modifications needed. So thank you, Renthal. I'll tell you about the other guys later on. But here's a conversation with myself and Chris Johnham talking shop. Thanks for listening. All right, everybody, next up here on the Fly Racing RacerX podcast, a gentleman I've known for a long time, and we were once co-workers, sort of, kind of, over at RacerX, and now with Johnham Media, he's very involved in the sport. From Johnham Media, PR man extraordinaire, Chris Johnham. What's up, Chris? How are you, man?
Hey, doing great. Thanks. How's it going, Steve?
I'm good, man. Thank you for doing this. Appreciate it. A lot of questions for you. You've done a lot in this industry, media side, and now you kind of on the other side of things where you're working with the media. So it's interesting. Johnham Media, I guess, you've done that for a while. Talk about starting it and what it is and what you're doing.
Yeah, so it's about 7 years in now. Mm-hmm. Like you said, I did some journalism before that and just sort of seemed like I was very fortunate with my journalism career. I had some great opportunities and really enjoyed it. And then I got to do, basically got to work for Cycle News and Road Racer X, and was sort of came to a point where I was no longer kind of had opportunities to keep growing there. Mm-hmm. And so, kind of just transitioned it into PR. And like you said, it's related, right? It's like I think my experience on the journalism side kind of helped me to understand what was needed a little bit. But mm-hmm. There's a lot to learn for sure. When I first got started, and I'm still learning every day.
Okay. It is interesting because Yeah, you've seen both sides of this, right? And by the way, you went to school for this, for journalism. Like, you got actual degrees, don't you? Like, you're like a real journalist, unlike me.
Well, it was my degree was in English lit, but okay. I guess it's kind of related.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good enough. So I guess let's start with this. You're John Media. One of your clients is Honda HRC on the motocross side. Are you doing also, like, stuff for like the UTVs and street bikes and that kind of stuff, or is it a motocross team only, or are you employed or contracted with Honda for a number of things across the board?
Yeah, it's a number of things.
Okay.
And you know, obviously the racing stuff's the fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I personally, you know, Tatiana that travels with the race team, she does it pretty much full time. I actually say that I spend probably a bigger percentage of my time on the non-racing stuff, which includes, you know, we do press releases, mm-hmm. PR documents, a lot of event planning. I have a guy, Corey, that does just almost entirely event planning, where he organizes and plans and executes press launches and things like that for Honda.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they, like you said, it can be dirt bike stuff, but it can also be ATVs, side-by-sides, street mm-hmm. bikes, touring bikes, sport bikes.
Yeah, so really, in a sense, like what Tatiana does is kind of the easy part, right? Like, I would think.
I wouldn't say that. I've done, you know, not with Honda, but I've done the full-time travel thing with the race team.
Yeah.
And it's pretty challenging. You gotta wear a lot of different hats. You gotta be able to adapt mm-hmm. And stuff. So, I mean, I'd say maybe it's the fun part.
Yeah.
If you don't mind the travel.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wouldn't say it's easy.
She's doing a great job, by the way. I don't know her that well, but she's kind of new on the scene. But yeah, she's doing a really great job
awesome.
Over there.
Thank
so
you.
So that's cool to see. And we'll get into that. And I may start ranting and raving, Chris, later on about some of that stuff. But okay, so you have other clients, or is Honda take up most of your time? It sounds like that's a pretty busy deal. Or are you looking for other clients and you harvest them as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always looking for other clients, and we do have other clients, mainly project work here and there. But mm-hmm. For sure, the business it was originally built around Honda, and that's the linchpin. That's what makes it work. Mm-hmm. And that's my bottom line is that's non-negotiable. I have to make sure that Honda's taken care of. And you know, I really like working with them. It's a great brand, great product, great people. So, mm-hmm. And we've been able to grow just with Honda too. You know, I don't really try to like upsell or anything like that, mm-hmm. but I try to just make sure that we're delivering on what they ask us to do. And if they need something, then sometimes they'll say, hey, what about those Johnham guys? They did a good job on this other thing. You know?
Right. Right. And I imagine some of your journalistic, ties and friends and contacts have helped you with the biz over the years, right? Like, I mean,
for sure.
Yeah. You know, people, when you were the enemy, quote unquote, being the media, like, I'm sure people are like, hey, Chris was awesome. He's good to deal with, you know, like, well, now he's involved in the PR side of things. So, I also, by the way, I'm involved on I work with the Yamaha guys, right? And,
yep.
And when you do talk about intros and you talk about the Blue Crew invitationals that they have and all of this, I kind of get a peek behind the curtain, new model launches, because I'm there when Yamaha launches a new YZFs and I got a UTV from them. It's a lot, man. There's a lot of things going on. Like, my contact at Yamaha, John Howell, dude, he is busy, and it is just juggling balls and media and equipment and facilities and trying to launch these products correctly. Like I said, like, the race team is probably such a small part of trying to line up all these balls in the air.
Yeah, and kind of going back to what you said about the journalism kind of helping me transition into this, I think, you know, it's changed a lot. I was back in like the 90s and mm-hmm. early 2000s. So it's a lot different now, but I still believe that it's a really good preparation for a lot of different things. You know, it teaches you, obviously you meet deadlines, which is important. You learn to communicate decently. You make a lot of contacts, because as a journalist, you're constantly, you know, interviewing people, and just like we're doing mm-hmm. right now. Right. So you just come into contact with a lot of different people. And I have found kind of that foundation to be super helpful in, just getting my business off the ground, and just also mm-hmm. just still just making it run well.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's the part where I'll praise Honda a little bit. And you were, you know, you're an older gentleman like I am. So you've been
even older, I think.
Yeah, maybe. But you've been around a long time, and you know how Honda used to be. I mean, even Eric Kehoe, who is a great guy, kept the cards close to the vest, you know. And you look down the line of Cliff White and all of these guys. I mean, you're more doing the road racing side, which we will dive into. But and then, you know, the Lawrence has come on board recently, fairly recent. And then Lars is put in spot. You know, his dad was once team manager back in the day, and he worked his way up from being, you know, basically practice bike mechanic to team manager. Brandon Wilson gets in there somewhere. I think he came from the parts department somewhere along the line. But, like, the vibe and the atmosphere at Honda, and I don't think it's any one person deserves all the credit, is so much different than what it used to be. I mean, even Lars, we did this whole shot contest at Washougal, and yeah, Lars is like, can you imagine what Cliff would think of this? or any old time, because of Honda for years, they won so much, they had an air of invincibility. I think I said that wrong.
Invincibility, yep.
Invincibility, that's it. Sorry. Invincibility. And, like, even when I was at Yamaha, the old timers there, dude, they would just start yelling and screaming about Honda. Like, this old school, like, I hate Honda, right? Like, all of that.
Yeah.
But, and you, again, you were, you know this, or you were part of it at Cycle News or the road racing side. But, dude, how about Honda now? Like, just a complete 180. maybe the coolest team in the pits. Kiefer and I rode the bikes a couple years ago. Lars let us do this ridiculous hole shot contest. The Lawrences are, you know, pretty friendly with everybody. Yep. The Darren, the Dat. I mean, dude, is there? I'm going on and on, Chris. But is there a cooler team than Honda these days? Right?
I mean, I'm going to tell you, yeah. But I really believe it. I mean, it's, and I feel very fortunate. I mean, it's, and I'm not going to actually take much credit for it either.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is mainly down to, like you said, Brandon and Lars. They both have kind of been around Honda for a long time and have a lot of different experience there, especially like Brandon's is more varied in terms of working for different departments and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Lars's is more kind of like from the bottom to the top.
Yep.
But they both just get it. They get it. What, you know, the, you know, PR, they get like having fun. They get how important it is to have a good vibe and a good atmosphere around the team. I mm-hmm. mean, that's so fundamental to the success, I believe. I think they've just found a good sort of balance between being professional mm-hmm. and also, you know, allowing, you know, some leeway and, you know, the athletes are all, I mean, especially the Lawrences, but all four of the guys are really good, fun guys that are actually very good at their job, both on and off the track. So mm-hmm. I'm, again, very, very lucky there. Don't have to do a lot of coaching or counseling or directing of them. And then kind of also, yeah, that I think you alluded to it a little bit, the sort of entourage, especially around the Lawrences, you know, that they've built up. It reminds me a little bit, you know, I think we'll probably talk about it. I worked when I was at Ducati, I worked with Valentino for a little bit
mm-hmm.
and, you know, he's such, or was such, a brand in and of himself, unto
yep.
himself,
yep.
that he had built up people that he trusted around him, and they were professional, and they did a good job, and that's sort of what the Lawrences have done, you know, between you know, Dazzy, Jacob, Johnny,
yeah.
Truman, the gear guys, everybody, and it's everybody kind of knows their role. You know, I don't pretend like I'm their buddy. I always say I want them to respect me as a professional. I've got my own friends. They've got their own friends.
Mm-hmm.
I want, you know, when Tati or I come up to them and ask them to do something, I want them to know, okay, these guys, they don't waste my time. If they respect my time. So if they're asking me to do something, that means it's actually worth my time.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. There is a line there you got to draw, right? Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we know at the end of the day, we're there to win races and, you know, it can be a distraction. I know that at times in my career, I've gone too far, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of like asking for their time and stuff like that. So, but at the same time, we do need to take care of the fans and sell bikes and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's a constant balance.
Yeah. I think it's a really, like, again, just the things that Lars is open with and he talks about and the team and the whole shot contest and all of that, like, that's just not happening with some management over the years at Honda. And that's, not coming down on anybody. That's just the way they believe, the way they acted, and they've decided to not be like that, you know?
Right, yeah. Yeah, and I think it's just a matter of just getting it. And Lars is actually, and it's more than that. It's actually being into it and enjoying it.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
So Lars, I think, does, you know, he like that whole whole shot thing, you know, that was, well, I mean, I think, I don't know if it was your idea or his, but he, it was his baby basically, mm-hmm. ultimately. And another great example is the Dean Wilson video, you know, the Grandpa Earl thing.
Right.
That was, I will say, I kind of just, I mean, that was his thing. Like he thought it up. He, like he actually wrote like a script for it. He like directed the thing. I mean, I pretty much just was like, I was trying to help where I could, but at a certain point, I'm just like, I'm just going to stand back and just let him eat, you know?
Yeah, no, it's really cool to see. And the team is, you know, embraced this and it's awesome to see.
Sure.
So on the flip side of that, obviously we know about their ex-agent and everything that they're going through, the Lawrence brothers. And then there was that video released. And I thought Jet handled it well, and the series handled it well, and everything was done right. I mean, he was a dumb thing to say as a kid, but how much, Chris, are you involved in something like that as far as like, okay, what are we doing? What's going on? I mean, again, the Lawrences are their own camp and this is their own thing going. But how much of that did you have a say in, or meetings and all of that?
I mean, we all that stuff, you know, we like, so one thing I really like about my company is that, or I mean, that my relationship with Honda, my mm-hmm. company's relationship with Honda, is that we really are, I think that they, we think of ourselves and I think they think of us as being an extension of Honda. So it's very collaborative. They include us in a lot of stuff, and we have our opportunity to give our take, and mm-hmm. and I think it's valued and considered seriously. And so yeah, I mean, all situations like that, I won't go into details, but just in any situation like that, we are brought in and kept in the loop and are part of those conversations.
Right. How did you think that whole thing was handled? How did you, from your end of things?
I mean, in general, I just think that, I mean, our riders and, you know, especially Jet, and Hunter, they're really good at the PR stuff, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, people want to hear what they have to say because they're very successful on the track. So they want to hear from them. They're the two brothers, they're very different. They have, you know, their personalities are different, and their communication is very different, but they're genuine. I think people can pick up on that. I think that's something, you know, people can identify when mm-hmm. somebody's fake or if they're authentic. And so I think at the end of the day, if you just be yourself and be as transparent as you can mm-hmm. reasonably, that people will give you the benefit of the doubt, and they'll understand, you know, if you make a mistake, they will understand kind mm-hmm. of where that you're a real person and you're doing your best. Cause I think most of the guys are,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. That's really a cool thing about our sport too, in a little bit, right?
Like, yeah.
Yeah. What's it like trying to, again, Darren and the boys keep a tight with Jacob Hayes, they keep a tight, camp there. And this is a broader question we'll get into later on, but for mm-hmm. John O'Media and Honda and what Honda needs from the Lawrence brothers, what they can give, what are the demands like coming in? What do they do going out? How is that balance? Because, like, let's face it, Jet is maybe the most popular off-road rider in the world. Mm-hmm. Probably some road race guys outrank him, you know, at the top, but like he's up there. So what's that like for you? Is it a constant source of pulling your hair out? Is it, you know, like, how is that for you, Chris?
So which part? Sorry. I mean,
yeah,
like
just
the demands.
The demands that you need from the Lawrences and Honda needs, and mm-hmm. then what they want to do and what they have their own stuff going on. Like, how, what's the balance of that?
It's not bad, really. I mean,
okay.
you know, just because, you know, I just, like, we, it's not like I actually don't need a lot of individual time with them.
Okay.
For PR stuff, right? It's at the races, there are windows, whether it's a press conference or an autograph signing,
mm-hmm.
you know, interviews after the after the motos or whatever. And it's not me personally who's doing it for the most part. Yeah. It's Tati. But like I said earlier, if I intentionally try to ask little of them as I think is reasonably needed, so that when I do ask, they understand that, okay, it's actually not going to be a waste of my time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just think it comes down to just respecting that they are there to do a job. And another thing is when we do ask them to do something, like say like a photo shoot or something.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I really want to make sure that we have our plan dialed and that, it's efficient and smooth and quick and not like some of these shoots where, they're sitting around for hours, yeah. Waiting. So, I like working with, photographers and videographers who mm-hmm. come from the race environment and they know how to turn stuff around quick. And they,
Chris, I've been part of some poster shoots in my Yamaha days where the riders are ready to kill the dude,
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And I have too. So I know, mm-hmm. again, it just comes down to just respecting that they're a professional. They have a finite amount of time. And, if I'm asking them to do something, I want to make sure that it's actually needed and that, that it's being mm-hmm. done quickly and efficiently.
How many things do you say no to just without even vetting it with any, like just requests from media requests and you're just like, can't do it.
I mean, we get some weird stuff, from time to time. Mm-hmm. And so, a lot of it gets, they're for sure. If it's obvious to me that it's a non-starter, then I have no problem, turning it down.
Yep.
A lot of the stuff we do run through Jacob, especially if it's away from the racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately he's a lot of times the one that will make those calls. But it's not bad because most, the moto media is pretty informed, pretty savvy, mm-hmm. just like the moto fans, the mm-hmm. moto audience. And so I think they kind of know what's realistic and what's not. So,
right.
We don't get too much stuff that's completely out there in left field.
Right. It does seem, and you and I have had some private conversations over the years about this. It does seem like, and the old agent was a little more controlling and a little more, I think, putting things in the family's ears about moto media, or maybe it was a bit of a strategy also. But it does seem like Hunter, Jet are more open to dealing with us moto media guys, either before the race, after the race, whatever it is. And I don't know how much of that had to do with the old agent or what, but I think their attitudes have changed a little bit. Do you see that? Do you agree? Or has it always been the same?
I mean, maybe they've done some really good interviews lately. Mm-hmm. I'll say that,
yeah.
And I don't know, I don't really have any idea, to be honest, if that was a conscious decision or anything like that. But, all four of the guys, I think, have been doing some really good long form interviews, podium interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And, as far as what that's down to, I can't honestly say.
Yeah. I think for me as a guy that's been there week to week, it does seem like a happier, lighter mood around them lately, in talking to us, So, by the way, Chris John, I'm here on the Fly Racing Racer X podcast. Use code PULPMX when you're checking out at Fly Racing. 2026 line is out and looking really, really good. We rode Washougal last weekend with some of the stuff. So thanks to the folks at Fly Racing. Maxxis Tires as well, Maxxis.com. Jeremy McGrath, fellow Honda rider, used to be a Honda rider, developed these Maxxis Tires and PRMX, International Supercross Race Team, using Maxxis Tires. Great mountain bike tires as well. From the folks at Maxxis Tires. So, Chris, next topic before we dive into a little bit of your personal journey, access to riders in moto media. It's been a hot topic lately. The press conferences, it doesn't really work for us. A lot of us guys that are boots on the ground moto media because we can mm-hmm. simply watch them after. And let's face it, Feld is doing that for themselves. And then we are not getting access. If we go to press conferences, we don't get access to riders outside the podium. And if we do get access to the riders on the podium, we won't get a one-on-one interview with these guys most of the time. Sometimes, yes, but most of the time, not. So I've had 8,000 discussions with Sean Brennan at Feld about this and also with Brandon Short and Davey about the outdoors. I'm not really stoked on Feld's strategy or what they I feel like they can just end this. They could make this really easy on all of us, Chris, but they chose not to, and that's fine. But I'm also not, you know, I also can choose which how I want to cover the sport for the fans. But let me ask you, a guy who comes from road racing, not for a while, but back in the day, where, as I understand, it was pretty mandatory to do a lot of media sessions, and it's not really mandatory in our sport outside of the top three. How do we fix this? Or what is it? Does it need to be fixed? A, how do we fix it? How does Chris Johnham fix this? You know, give me some thoughts here. Yeah.
There's a lot in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I'll just kind of dive into it. So if, compared to say MotoGP, when I was working in MotoGP, yeah, there is a lot more availability, to the riders. But it's also a much different situation. So, you know, let's just go to like take a typical MotoGP race. Mm-hmm. You arrive like on Wednesday if you're on the team. They have media day on Thursday. They have practice on Friday, qualifying on Saturday, racing on Sunday. Sometimes I'll have a test on Monday. So there's just a lot more time, period, right? And then like say like Supercross, it's happening. Sometimes not as late as traditionally, a lot.
Yeah.
It's usually pretty late in the day. And so, you know, it can get to be like midnight sometimes by the time people are getting out of the pits. So there's just a lot more time in MotoGP. But yes, they will schedule in, basically it could be different now, but when I was doing it, it was top three guys of the day would have a actual organized press conference from the promoter. And then actually pretty much everybody else, like the media would travel around from hospitality to hospitality and have like a little, mini scrum or even sort of semi-organized press conference in the hospitality. But it's just, again, a lot different. The pits are different. The hospitalities themselves are different, you know? So I just kind of provide that as a little bit of context. It's a lot more challenging to schedule time with riders on when you've just got a quick Saturday program, Saturday only, which by the way, I prefer. I really like, I like how tight it is run in the States in moto and supercross.
Yep. Yep.
You know, and I think to kind of defend Feld a little bit, they definitely regularly talk to us and all the teams about the best way to do these things. And, there's a lot of different opinions. I think that, you know, that one of the nice things about press conferences is that they're easy for non-endemic media. Mm-hmm. So I believe that that's sort of the goal there is you're trying to make things as easy as possible to attract non-endemic media to come in and cover your sport. But I get it that it's also kind of regimented and controlled and it's not that one-on-one sort of informal feeling that you guys, the hardcore guys that are there week in and week out,
you
know, value and need.
I was telling Sean one time I timed Eli Tomac and he spoke for 1:10 in a press conference and then didn't do any interviews afterwards. And I said to Sean, so you win this race and he speaks for 1:10 and that's it. That's all he speaks. And everybody's good with that. And Sean was like, well, not really. But I'm like, well, then help us out. Like, this is the guy who won a massive Supercross, 1:10. And on all the cliches, you know, all the normal cliches in that 1:10, right? Because it was just like one question from three guys, basically. So, like, I don't know. I'm just like, wait, I feel like there should be more media.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's valid. I mean, how would you like to do it? What do you think is the best way?
Well, I've proposed this many times, and we had a PR summit at Tampa this year. I couldn't make it with I had commitments on Thursday and couldn't get in time on Friday to get there. We spoke about this with some teams, and I'm sure Tatiana was there. And from people, from other media guys there, like it went nowhere. It went absolutely nowhere with the teams. So I don't really know what the idea is. But for me, Chris, I've literally asked Sean and Joe, I've given them like three different ways of doing this. You know, I've spoken to the Yamaha guys as well about their riders because they have three high profile riders. If I could wave a magic wand And I understand it's late and it's cold in some of these stadiums, and we all want to get the hell out of there. Like, absolutely, right? We've been there since 8 a.m. I would do the press conference. Those three guys then don't have to speak again if they don't want to. And then I would make it mandatory for the top 10 to go to a corral somewhere, inside, outside, whatever, depending on weather. And and for 30 minutes, the top 10 have to sit there. And all of us can go to one corral. We don't got to wander around the pits like zombies looking for fresh meat. And we know the top 10 will be in this corral. And we can get the press conference stories, and we can get the top 10 stories. And anybody else, we can wander around and look for that. But mandatory top 10 speak after every race for 30 minutes. I feel like that's not too much to ask.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably legit. You know, I think it depends. I think you have to kind of, in that case, keep the press conference itself kind of tight. I think they've because really the press conference, if you're a mainstream, you know, non-endemic guy or a woman, your main thing is you just want to get a quote that sort of summarizes how their day went, right? You don't really need a lot of probing questions or anything like that. So, you know, maybe if you know, do it sort of a tight press release or press conference, and then sort of the one-on-one parade or whatever, that, you know, in a corral or something. I think part of the challenge is sometimes where do you do it? And I personally kind of liked, I think it was for SMX, where they'll actually do the press conference out in the pits. You know, and for outdoors, it's obviously, that's not really a problem. But for Supercross, sometimes it's, if you're in a, you know, you have to kind of walk. If you're in the pits, you have to walk to one end of the stadium and wherever the press conference room is and do that. And then come back to the pits and try to, you know, do the scrum there sometimes. I don't know. It just, that's a lot of time kind of going back and forth.
Sure.
I don't know what the perfect answer is. For trust me, it's been a conversation that's gone in circles. You know.
Oh, I know. Trust me, I've been part of it. Yeah, absolutely.
But I don't just want to act like I'm blowing off what you're saying, because I know that you guys. I mean, basically, my job in PR at the end of the day is to make it as easy as possible for the media to cover my client, right?
Yep.
There's a lot. I mean, there's. I think back when I was doing it, it was a hard job for sure, but it was a, kind of a one-dimensional job. What we needed, I was at Cycle News, and if I was at a Supercross or an outdoor, what I needed was not that different from what like New York Times guy would need or something like that, right? I was writing a race report in Cycle News, and I needed just a general quote about how the guy's day went. I didn't have space to put much more
than
that.
Right.
If I wanted to do a profile or interview, that was something that I would do outside the race, you know?
Yeah.
And that was maybe more possible back then too. But nowadays I know you guys, you know, you've got websites, social media, podcasts, you know, YouTube. I mean, there's still actually in moto compared to on road, there's still a good number of magazines around still even.
Yeah.
So, it's just kind of a lot of different needs.
Yeah, and even, Chris, we even have, like, so there's the video aspect of a post-race interview, right? And there's, I don't do that. I do audio only, but Vital and RacerX and TransSwap and everybody does these videos. Well, now we have riders saying to the media, more than two I can think of, over two, that are telling the reporters, man, I don't want to do this. You're just making money on me. And like, they're right? Because YouTube, the Google revenue from YouTube. But it's like, holy shit, man, that's where we're at. Like, what is going on? Where the rider's like, you're just making money off me. You know, like, that's where PR people, and this isn't a Honda, anybody at Honda, by the way.
Okay, good.
Yeah, nobody at Honda. But, like, that's where PR needs to step in and be like, no, man. This is part of your gig. You're a marketing arm of our bikes, you know? But that's where we're at. Like, it's not good.
No, I mean, you know, I agree. It's part of the job of a team and a manufacturer and a rider. I worked with, when I was in MotoGP, I also worked with Nicky
and Hayden,
And he like from when he was a kid, he, this is, I, you know, had conversations with his dad and stuff, and he decided that he wanted to be a professional racer. And, but he like pretty early on, I think, thanks to his dad, he understood that that was all aspects, 360 degrees. It wasn't just on the track. It was, you know, it was taking care of yourself between races. It was, doing the interviews and stuff. I mean, I was in, whatever year it was when, Simoncelli, was killed. You know, mm-hmm. I was in the garage with, you know, standing there with Nikki, and, some journalists came up outside the garage, and he walked over to them and did an interview, and he was like, you know, yeah. he was friends, you know, these guys are yeah. friends just like they are in moto.
Yep.
And so, I think that is, if you consider yourself to be a professional athlete, that is one component of your job.
Yeah.
So
I even proposed to Yamaha. I'm like, look, you have Justin Cooper, Cooper Webb, and Eli Tomac, three superstars, or two superstars and Justin Cooper, whatever you want to say. But I was like, how about this, guys? After each round, you schedule one of your three riders to talk to us after the race, and that way we won't bug the other two. So Eli Tomac, win, lose, or draw. Obviously, if there's an injury or something, it changes. But win, lose, or draw, Eli, at Detroit, you will spend 30 minutes after the race talking to the media. And then the next week is Cooper Webb, and the next week is Justin Cooper, and they rotate. And that way, each guy knows that once a month, he's got to stay 30 minutes after the race. And we won't bug the other two riders because we know it's not their week. And we know that – and this is like – so all we're asking for – I thought it was a good idea. I said all we're trying to do is talk to one of these riders once a month. Like, and this all came from, Chris, 2 years ago, Malcolm Seward and Barsha, who are great guys, by the way, and I have good relationships with them. They never did – they weren't on the podium, and they weren't having a greatest season. They never spoke to the media all year long. And, like, they would just grab their stuff after the race and take off. And I was telling the teams and telling Feld, like, sorry, they're not having a good year. They haven't spoken once. They have not spoken once to any of us after the race. And that's just not acceptable. You know, these guys have fans. They are marketing arms of their machine, of their bike. And I'm just like, can we do something? And, again, love Sean and Joe and guys at Feld. They've been nothing but good to me. But, like, they just can't seem to help us get it. And yeah, it's a topic, like I said, I was going to rant and rave about it, but just, it needs to get a lot better in my opinion. Obviously I'm super biased. I'm on the side of the media, but it needs to get a lot better.
Yeah. But I mean, I think for the most part, you guys, like, the cool thing is, you know, this segment of the moto media, like, I'm sorry, of power sports media, like dirt bike guys, you guys, I mean, I was one of you. Most of us were former racers ourselves. For me, it was a very amateur level. But so I think that we, by nature, are competitive, and we want to deliver. You know, we want to do a good job. And you know, you guys are, I think, kind of going back to what I said about me trying to respect the time of the athletes. I think that from what I've seen, you know, for the most part, the moto media does. They're not.
Yeah.
You're not.
Yeah, we're not TMZ guys. You know, we. Yeah. I mean, I've had plenty of people. Not plenty. I've had, you know, a dozen riders over my years say, "Hey, not tonight." And I'll be like, "Yeah, no, cool.
Yeah,
no problem, man. Like, absolutely. Yeah. See you next week." You know. So.
Yeah, and if you get an opportunity, you're efficient with their time, and So yeah, I mean, I just say we both, you know, John and media and Honda and the team, I think we honestly, we appreciate the work that you guys do. We need the work that you guys do. We value it. And so,
yeah,
you know,
ultimately,
I'm sorry if,
yeah, no, listen, it's fine. Ultimately, it needs to be Feld or MX Sports that step up in my eyes, because, you know, these riders aren't, the tail wags the dog. So they're going to do what they're going to want to do. And that's how it goes. But I mean, to me, but on the flip side, so I've done nothing but complain for the last 10 minutes. On the flip side, Chris, it's you know, I have friends in other sports that cover other sports. I have a buddy of mine that covers the Toronto Maple Leafs in hockey, and he goes to every single game. He has personal relationships with the players. and like some of them, not all of them. And he's got their phone numbers, and he cannot call them for an interview or text them. Like the team PR would lose it on him, perhaps even pull his pass. And I can text Chase Sexton or Jet Lawrence right now and get something or ask them, or you know what I mean? And most of the time these guys get back to us. So again, I want to put the positive with the negative. The positive is that most of the time these athletes for the Pulp MX show on Monday or whatever are generally available, you know? So
yeah, that's good to hear.
Yeah. You know, so that's a good part of our sport, because again, my buddy who covers the Maple Leafs, I'm like, can't you just text a guy and be like, hey, what do you think of this? And then do a story on it. He's like, oh, no, no, no. I said, even though the guy's your friend and he doesn't care and he will talk to you. And the guy's like, oh, yeah, just can't do it, you know? So that's bizarre to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's, again, it's just it's a balance. I mean, obviously you can't have everybody doing that, but you you've been there for years and have, you know, built those relationships. And and so, yeah, I think that's understandable.
Chris Johnham here on the Fly Racing Racer X podcast. I want to thank the folks at motorsport.com, of course. They've got the Ultimate Ride Sweepstakes going on. Anything you need from moto or road racing or UTVs or e-bikes even, go through the banner on pulpmx.com to order from motorsport.com. Great guys. Free shipping on everything over $79. They got the Ultimate Ride Sweepstakes going on. I think grand prize is a YZ250F. I think they've given that away. I need to check my notes here. Through August 25th. No, still going on. Check out the Ultimate Ride Sweepstakes over there at motorsport.com. Weekly prizes are great, too, as well. All right, Chris, time to get into a time machine a little bit and get into your journey a little bit. Let's talk about it. So you start at Cycle News, but, like, where does the love of two-wheel, either moto or street, get started for you?
So I grew up out in the Dez in Antelope Valley. Mm-hmm. Had an XR75 when I was a kid, and my dad rode enduros out there, just 37 enduros,
like Honda Valley and all that. Is that what you're talking about?
Let's see. I was in the middle of nowhere. So,
okay.
I went to Palmdale High, but I lived like east of Palmdale, about a half hour past Pear Blossom, a little town called Llano, not too far from where the Gosslers.
Is that like where Hannah used to ride too?
So Hannah was like Bean Canyon, which I did go ride there quite a bit. He was like, that's a little bit north and west from me. I just think of it being like halfway between Palmdale and like Hesperia.
Okay.
Roughly. Rode my dirt bike all the time as a kid. My family did a lot of trail riding out in the desert, or go to Colorado a lot of summers and do dual sport. Now we call it dual sport riding. Back then it was just dirt bike riding.
Yeah.
And then I eventually started racing enduros myself. Had like an XR200 and an XR350 before everything was four strokes. Went to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo because they had a motorcycle club.
Oh, okay.
So I was an English lit major, which they're definitely not known for. They're more like an engineering, agricultural school and stuff. But I was able to, they had like a garage on campus, so I could live in the dorm and keep my bike in the garage and go riding on the weekends and stuff. And they put on, back then they put on an enduro every year. Now I think it's a dual sport ride. I did like an internship for 1 year with Acerbis like 1990, where I actually had an opportunity to live in Italy for 1 year.
How do you get that?
It's a little bit of a story. I had an idea for a rear disc brake protector. So if you remember, like with the conventional forks, they had the brake guards also kind of extended up the fork leg.
And yeah. Yeah.
So my idea was do the same thing for the rear disc brake, that, but it just protected the swing arm as well.
Okay.
I think I was like in high school or maybe community college at the time. And, I just sketched up a picture of it and, looking through one of the magazines and found the address for Acerbis and sent it in. And they actually ended up making it. It was terrible. It made the brake run too hot.
Franco was like, this idiot kid.
Yeah, pretty much. but it kind of got my foot in the door. Okay. They paid me a little bit and they sent me a bunch of cool stuff.
Oh, like that's awesome. You know, that's a really cool rally story.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Kid from the high des gets to move to Italy to help at Cherubis.
It's one of those situations where like, you know, sliding doors where like the past, like you do this one little thing.
Yep.
You have no idea the impact it's going to have on your life, you know?
Yeah.
It got me into the motorcycle industry. I went and lived in, you know, I learned Italian, lived in Europe and mm-hmm. made a bunch of friends over there and stuff. Franco was freaking one of the best people I've ever met in my life.
Was just he? Yeah. Awesome. Talon Volan loves him. Talon Volan talks a lot highly about him, yep. right? He's basically given him everything, right? Franco
exactly.
has. Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's just the most generous, charismatic guy in the world. He put me up over there. I wasn't making much money, but I was, he put me up in a nice, yeah, it was actually his family's kind of weekend mm-hmm. place. I had a roommate there, but, lived over there for a year, and got to go to a bunch of the races. I drove, that was the year, the 6 days was in Sweden.
Okay.
And, so I drove like a little Renault minivan with two other employees, drove all the way from Italy up to Sweden for that. And I would drive, I was driving around like a box van. They import, still import, I think, Scott bicycles there.
Okay. Yeah.
Into Italy. So there was like trade shows and stuff. And I'd have like a box van full of Scott bicycles.
How old are you? How old are you at this point?
I was like I had just finished my junior year in college. So I was, you know, 21, something
okay.
like that.
Awesome.
Probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, just completely open. I, to be honest, I had never been on an airplane before I went to Italy. Just like the guy that picked me up at the airport, Fabrizio, he's like we're still friends today.
Oh, awesome.
So just once in a lifetime opportunity that just completely like changed who I am as a person and just yep. opened up all these doors for me. Just very, very fortunate. But did that for a year, came back and finished school. And then, which I still had my senior year left. So I did that. And then when I graduated, I just had sent out, I wanted to work in the motorcycle industry. So
yep.
I just kind of bombarded everybody with unsolicited resumes. And I just wanted anything. I didn't care.
Did you race at all? Did you race moto? Like, were you doing any of that?
Up until then, I mainly raced just amateur enduros.
Okay.
You know, like
yeah,
I think I got to the A level.
Okay.
But I was pretty average.
Yeah.
And that was one cool thing about San Luis Obispo is I had grown up racing mainly District 37 enduros down mm-hmm. south, but when I was there, I could also go up and do some of the enduros in District 36 up in NorCal. I did mainly enduros because when I was young, my family, they didn't want me racing moto because they were worried about me getting hurt with the jumps and the mass starts and stuff. I did a couple desert races like Hare and Hounds where those are definitely dangerous too, mm-hmm. And I did a little bit of moto, but I had not really raced a whole lot of moto up until then.
Okay.
So you sent out
a resume.
Yeah. Yep. One of the resumes I'd sent to was to Cycle News and, got a call one day. This is before email and, you know, cell phones and stuff. This was like 91, 92. Mm-hmm. So Jack Mangus, who's was the editor with Cycle News back then, who he was a really difficult boss in some ways, but I also really learned a lot. Like stuff to this day that I use every day, like that he taught me.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, "Hey, we got a job for an assistant editor to cover Supercross and motocross and test dirt bikes. And we'll pay you $24,000 a year."
Oh, you were in heaven though, I bet.
I was like, I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like don't act too anxious. Right? It's really hard to get. No, but it was that, I mean, and honestly there wasn't much money, but it was more than I'd made yet.
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah.
And did that actually, at the time, the guys that sort of showed me the ropes was Kit Palmer, who's still there.
Yeah. Legend. Legend.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And Don Maeda was there at the time.
Yeah. How funny is it on some of these old Cycle News, you see Don Maeda and Davey Coombs with the same byline.
Like, yeah.
It's insane. They were both in the same race. One guy covered 250s, one guy covered 125s or whatever. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I worked really closely with Davey. He was not like in-house, but mm-hmm. he covered a ton of stuff for us and made friends with him. And then eventually Mangus was replaced by Paul Carruthers.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a lot more fun. I got to work under Paul for a few years. I was there off and on for like 10 years, I think.
Okay. Oh, that long. I didn't know it was that long. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I did a couple of, I took a couple of breaks. Like, I worked for a mountain bike magazine for a couple of years that was owned by, I worked under Tom Webb.
With, oh, like a high torque.
Yeah. Peterson, which
oh,
was,
Peterson. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So Dirt Rider. It was when Tom Webb was a Dirt Rider, not when he was a dirt bike.
I did a podcast with Tom 6 months ago, 7 months. It was great.
Oh, cool.
Loved it. I took him years for him to agree to do one with me. And he heard Carl Kramer's with me, and then he decided he would do one. But
gotcha.
Super interesting. Yeah, the Wolfman. Right.
Yeah, for sure. And I had read his stuff, you know,
right,
as a kid growing up and everything. And So I like I said, I did a couple of hiatuses.
Mm-hmm.
I worked very, very briefly with FMF for like literally a few days. But actually, Cycle News also had a jet ski magazine that I did some work on. But just had amazing experiences, just like you would imagine, like the ones that he had told me about over the phone, hired me, but also like I got to do like a couple of off-road tours in Costa Rica and Mexico. I covered the Nations in 2000 when it was Carmichael, Pastrana, and Ryan Hughes.
Oh, in France,
St. John d'Angeli. I got to ride there was a big race called the Nevada Rally. I rode that like in 94, actually with almost kind of as an embedded factory Honda rider. With Johnny Campbell and Jimmy Lewis and Tom Webb was actually on that team. Chuck Miller. Racing.
Yeah. Is Chuck still at Honda or is he retired?
No, he's retired.
Yeah. He's retired. Yeah. Okay. That's pretty cool. Yeah. And so you early on, you got into I've talked to so many media guys over the years, and some of them, the guys that I grew up reading, like Tom or Super Hunky, I talked to one time.
Yeah.
It's you work so many hours for not a lot of pay, but and I think I'm the same way. Like, this is what you've dreamed of. This is like so cool.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, pretty much my whole career has just been like dream jobs, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, like just that was just for a young kid growing up around dirt bikes and wanting to get his toe in the industry, you know, that was, there's no better way. And it was gnarly. Like, I was not, somehow I'd gotten through college not being a great typist.
Mm-hmm.
And like when Jack Mangus first found that out, he's like, oh man, why did I hire this guy? You know? So, cause you're on a Sunday night, back then the Nationals were on Sundays.
Yeah.
And so you're like out there, a lot of times you're shooting your own photos, on black and white film. And you're dusty and hot and sunburned and you go back to your hotel and you're just destroyed and you have to like stay up all night writing your story. You know, it was like 3,000, 4,000 word stories back then.
Yeah.
You know?
And Kit told me about I guess you were probably around with the faxes. You would fax it or what would you do?
Yeah. Yeah. So I would actually, when I was working in the office, we would receive faxes from people doing stories and stuff. But mm-hmm. for us that were like staffers, we had these little, Radio Shack. There's like laptop prototypes.
Yeah,
basically.
That's it. Right. This kid was telling me about this thing.
Yeah, dude, it was like powered by like AA batteries. It had like a tiny little screen. It didn't even fold. It was just like a flat thing, when you got toward the end of your story where it's like getting to be, the memory would start to fill up and it would be running slower and slower, you know, you're like, you have to scroll back up to change your lead. And it would be like 5 minutes just to scroll to the top of your story, you know?
So you had to file this stuff every Sunday night. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of times it was Don that would be on the other end. And like, I would call him up from the hotel phone and we would like plug in Radio Shack computers into it. He had one too back.
Yeah,
back,
yeah. You had to both have one and do it at the same time or something. Kit was saying, right?
Exactly. And you would like time the timing like 1, 2, 3, and you both push a button and it literally like flows out of my computer, gone over the phone line to his computer. And if you miss time the pushing of the button, it just like vanishes, just poofs, and you have to start over. Which fortunately, it was mainly Don. It's like when I was back home, it was sometimes. I think it was mainly like Don was sending he was covering dirt track back then. So he'd like be covering some, you know, race in Peoria and he'd send me a story back and I'm back in California on the receiving end. And it was probably me that screwed up the timing of it and And I was like, oh, dude, you didn't do that. It's yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. That's the early days of Moto Media for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember like when we first started getting digital, when digital photography first started happening, you know, that we could have, we could get photos from, you know, like Europe overnight and do yeah. like, you know, GP coverage the next day and stuff. So,
did you have any memorable moments of pissing riders off or anything, Chris? Like any ones that stand out for you?
Not really. The first race that I covered by myself, there's a couple where I was like helping Kit and stuff, but the first that I covered by myself was Redbud 92. And I think that was the race where, I know that was the race where, Kudrowski got his first 250 win. Mm-hmm. Emmett got his first 125 win, and they both went on. They both sort of came from behind to win the championship that year.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the beginning of when that comeback was happening. But I think the Redbud race might have been where Bradshaw had a big crash.
Oh, and he's like, throwing rocks at MXA guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Matt Koger and Chris Holtner.
Right. Right.
so I was a journalist too. We were kind of friends, and I got to sort of experience that. But as far as like pissing riders off, nothing comes to mind.
Yeah.
Hopefully
Kit. Yeah. Kit's such a legend. We do these re-raceables pods and we pull up the old Cycle News and read the article about the old race we're talking about. And 8 times out of 10, it's written by Kit Palmer. And we just laugh because Kit's still out there, man. He's just a great guy. Yeah.
And it's like, that's such a grind, man, that he's got such endurance, you know, that, I mean, especially back when we were doing it, the weekly schedule, it sounds kind of crazy to compared to like the now, like the basically hourly schedule, but the weekly pace was pretty brutal compared to like the monthly guys. And we had a pretty small staff.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's been through it and he's still doing a great job and still buddies and see him at the races and stuff, you know?
I'm like I said, I'm old now and I grew up reading Cycle News, even though I'm from Canada, and we would get, if you subscribed to Cycle News in Canada, you would just get 4 issues at once and then you would wait a month and get the next 4. Like it never came every Tuesday, you know? So, but anyways, I've written 1,000 stories in 1,000 magazines and all over the world. Right. And all of this stuff. And I don't keep any of it. I don't really care all that much about it at this point. At one point it was cool, but I'll tell you what I still have, Chris, is Kit got me to write the back page a few times of Cycle News when it was still a magazine. Henny Ray Adams spot, right? And I still have those Cycle News because I just couldn't believe I got to write the back page, because that's where, even though I wasn't into road racing, I would still read that stuff, right? Because it was always interesting. Yeah. It was always a little controversial or a little opinionated. And Kit let me do it for 3 or 4 issues, and I still have those Cycle News where I'm on the back page of Cycle News. Incredible.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, those stand out for me too, is columns. I mean, I like, you know, race reporting, it's kind of,
yeah, it is what it is, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But like columns is a place where you can, you have like you usually have like less than 1,000 words, like maybe 800 to 1,000 words. So you need to kind of get your point across in that amount of space, and you need to usually, it's an opinion thing a lot of times. So you need to kind of try to support your opinion and, you know, have a convincing argument. And I really, those are my columns stand out for me too. And I think were very enjoyable and, you know, kind of improved a lot as a writer, I would say, by doing columns.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, I write on the internet now mostly, and it's just the space is unlimited, but yeah, you have 1,000 words to make this point, back it up, reinforce it, get some quotes and get out of it in 1,000 words. It's a little bit of an art, you know?
Yeah, for sure. It's really good when you're able to kind of like do like have kind of close up and put a bow on it where it kind of loops back to the beginning somehow, you know?
Yep. Yeah, for sure. It was cool to for Kit to, first of all, Kit's a legend. Then he asked me and he knew me and he asked, I just, the whole thing blew me away. You know, I was like,
yeah, no, that's awesome.
So you're at Cycle News for a long time. Things are, and it's a grind, like you said. So when does Davey Coombs come in with Road Racer X? And were you into street bike racing and MotoGP and all of that beforehand?
So I didn't really grow up being into it, you know, but at Cycle News, you were kind of curiously exposed to it. So like I would help out Paul Carruthers maybe at Laguna Seca or something, you know, you know, they did a street bike shootout or something. I would ride a sport bike or a touring bike or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had some exposure to it. And of course you're editing. I would sometimes edit stories that some of our stringers from overseas, from Europe and stuff are sending over.
Right.
So I had that exposure to it, but no, I'd be lying if I said I was a big road race expert. Mm-hmm. But this would have been like, I think 2002 or so, Davey wanted to start a road race magazine, and he kind of took a chance on me. Just, you know, we were friends, and I think he, you know, he knew that I was a journalist, and yep. kind of hopefully had some respect for me there. So, and I, you know, I had one thing I knew from, like I said, I worked at a mountain bike magazine. I mm-hmm. worked at a jet ski magazine. So I had some experience about just diving into the deep end and, just really getting up to speed quickly. And I was comfortable around, I was comfortable in Europe, and I spoke Italian. So, I very quickly sort of made inroads in the MotoGP world for those reasons. So
what he, Davey says, "Hey, Chris, I want to start a road race magazine, and this, mm-hmm. you need to be based in Europe. Are you in?" Like, basically, like, is that, was it?
So he didn't say I had to be based in Europe, okay. but, I did end up, I like very quickly because that, so that was like 2003, I think is when we started it. And we had a bunch of Americans in MotoGP. There was Nicky, Colin Edwards, mm-hmm. John Hopkins, Kenny Roberts Jr. There was, it was, and it was also like when MotoGP was transitioning from two stroke to four stroke. So it was just, that was pretty much mm-hmm. where things were happening in road racing.
Okay.
And so I started off, I would just travel to a few GPs every year. And of course I was going to a lot of, AMA stuff too.
Yeah.
And then I had an opportunity. I had a French buddy from Paris who had an apartment and had a family, and he wanted to come live in California for a while. So we ended up like trading. we house swapped.
No way. Really?
yeah. We house swapped for like a year or something. And I was able then to like, you know, go to more GPs, but also, do kind of off the wall stories that there's no way I could have justified the budget to Davey. I'm like, yeah. I'm going to fly over and do this story on this French national, you know?
Yep.
I was based in Europe for part of the time during that experience too.
And so, I mean, I, you know, obviously Eric Johnson's a buddy of mine, and Davey, I've yep. talked to a bunch. Are you like, just, you're probably mostly a one man band for this magazine. Are you just doing everything and anything? Like, the workload is crazy.
I mean, it was a crazy workload. It was a bi-monthly, so that
okay.
helped.
Yeah.
Eric was very involved in it too. So he did a ton of writing.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of doing a lot of the issue planning and story assignments and things like that. And of course editing and, working with the graphic design people, Langers and, and you know, Scott Wallenberg and this ad sales department stuff. But it was cool because we basically had the perfect model, like Racer X, you know?
Mm-hmm. Davey's like, here's how it works. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. He had kind of, I think, been pretty much a pioneer in terms of like, I think he in the past has called it maybe like a surf magazine for moto or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more like lifestyle and, you know, and again, now media is so different, but back then it was still, magazines were still huge, you know? And so like, it was a lot, the photography was very important. That graphic design was very important. And just I really enjoyed the sort of the story ideas, coming up with creative story ideas. Like you're going to go cover a race. It's not going to come out until the issue's not coming out until like a month and a half later. How mm-hmm. can you make that interesting to the reader? And it's not going to be like a cycle news where it's just straight up race reporting, right? So you have to kind of find a different angle. A lot of it's personality based and mm-hmm. stuff. But we, just like Racer X, I think was pretty much a pioneer in moto in that regard. Road Racer X was a pioneer in the road racing world. And we, like the industry, the riders were very welcoming because they liked seeing, everybody likes to look cool. And I think that's what it does, is those types of magazines. They make your sport, they make you mm-hmm. as an athlete, make you look cool, you know? So we had great, you know, kind of going back to our earlier conversation, we had great access for the most part, you mm-hmm. know, like Nicky did a monthly column for us. You know, we were teams would let us come, yeah. you know, see the race from their perspective, things like that. It was really cool.
Yeah. So, okay. So at the time, like, yeah, how much competition was there for road race magazines? And I don't know anything about it. So like, Was it like, obviously with Racer X coming along, I mean, yeah. MXA and these other magazines were just test based light yeah. racing stuff. And Davey just blew the lid off them with cool coverage and cool ideas. And here's our sport from another angle. Was that the same as Road Racer X, where like no one was doing what?
It was similar, yeah. Just like with Moto, there were other ones that were doing what they did very well, like you're talking about high torque and stuff, right?
Yep.
In road racing, or in, let's just say, in on road or pavement world, two wheel asphalt world, there was magazines like Cycle World and Sport Rider, who were very test focused, and huge audiences, huge readerships, much larger than ours. And then there was Road Racing World, which is John Ulrich's magazine, which is, I think, still, I mean, for sure, the website's still around. He was very hardcore into racing, and but it was more kind of like fact-based, just reporting type stuff and testing.
Yeah. Yep.
So what we were doing was different, and it was just kind of like where Racer X kind of saw their niche.
Yeah,
that's kind of what we did with Road Racer X, and it was just tough because it was at a time when the media industry, not even just in moto but in general, was starting to suffer the effects of the internet and some other stuff. There was some turmoil in the AMA series.
Yeah. I mean, once they sold, right, it got to be.
It's much better now, Moto America, but for a few years there, it was pretty bad. And people just weren't interested in it anymore. Fans weren't interested in it anymore. So I think we lasted about 8 years, and
was the ad revenue okay? Was it supporting it that way? Was that tough?
I wasn't exposed too much to the business side of it, but I think that was probably part of the reason for its ultimate demise, is that there was just, with digital, there was your ad dollar could be more efficiently spent. And
can you imagine Carrie just yelling at Davey about this the money pit that Road Racer X was, probably? I don't know. You got Johnum backpacking across Europe.
Exactly. I traveled pretty cheap, but yeah, I'm sure it was, I can't imagine they were making a ton on us.
No. Did you like covering MotoGP or American Series, one or the other, or did it matter? What was the athlete access like, or anything else just in general?
I liked MotoGP kind of for those reasons I was saying before, just because that was where the excitement was during those years.
Yeah. For the Americans and everything. Yep.
Yeah, the Americans, and the fact that the sport had switched to this four stroke platform, which was, the promoters were doing a really good job, and I just liked I because of my background, I was able to, work my way into those teams pretty quickly, and there's a lot of Italians in MotoGP, like mechanics and. Just everybody there, a lot of the teams are based in Italy and stuff. So just being able to speak that language, helped a ton. And also they were trying to crack the nut in the US, they're trying to they're maybe a little more open to trying something with us than they might've been for, say, a Spanish magazine or something.
Sure. Fly Racing Racer X podcast, Chris Johnum here. Again, I want to thank the folks at Brunt Workwear. The code Mathis will save you. Their best-selling Marin work boots are not only built for the toughest job sites, they're completely waterproof. Whether it's rain, mud, or standing water, your feet will be dry. They're not just about the work boots. They offer a full range of high-performance gear. Bruntworkwear.com, code Mathis to save. And man, they don't just, choosing work boots used to mean sacrificing comfort or durability, but Brunt thought that was BS. So they built tough boots feel great from day one. What was Nicky Hayden like, Chris? Like my buddy Paggio was buddies with him. I know Davey knew him, Eric. I imagine, like you said, he wrote a column for you. He seemed like a great guy. He seemed like a really, really cool guy. He loved moto. He did the TT in Peoria a little bit here and there. Family's a long-standing motorcycle family. What was Nicky Hayden like?
He was just like you would hope. I mean, he was the real deal. He was from day one. Like when I think Davey might have introduced me to him, and when he was first starting the Road Race magazine, and he just makes you feel like he's your best friend, from day one, just down to earth, genuine. And like I kind of said before, just very professional, understanding that it's a job and that you're asking for mm-hmm. him to do is not because, you know, not for fun or something, just because it's your job, you know? So, we worked very closely at Road Racer X. And then 2006 was when he won the world championship. And, so there was a lot happening with him and, mm-hmm. and Red Bull and stuff that I was involved in. I did a podcast with him and I did like one of the, before podcast was a thing, I mm-hmm. did a podcast with Red Bull on him and John Hopkins. We were both Red Bull guys at the time. I think it was pretty terrible thanks to me, but they were awesome. I didn't even know, I'd never even listened to a podcast when they had me do it. Through that, I got to know him. And then, so in 2006, when he was doing pretty well, I asked him if he would ever want to do a book. And he said he'd kind of think about it or whatever, and then kind of forgot about it. I kind of forgot about it. And then a little bit later, his agent contacted me, and we actually agreed and it wasn't just on him. It was on all three brothers. It was their kind mm-hmm. of official biography. So I really got to know him well during that time. And he's actually, when Road Racer X did shut down, he's actually the one that called me up and he said, he didn't even know at the time. It was just kind of, mm-hmm. Fortunate timing. He didn't know that the magazine was closing down. He's like, hey, he was at Ducati. He's like, hey, they need a new press officer. Do you know anybody that you could refer to me? And I'm like, I might know a guy.
Wow. That was pretty fortunate. Yeah. Geez.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's been a lot of stuff, kind of like the cycle news thing with, you know, it's just been a lot of stuff of being in the right place at the right time in my career.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah, he seemed like a great guy, you know, for sure. Yeah. Tragic accident.
For sure.
Him winning Laguna Seca too. I'm not a road race guy, but that had to have been such a cool moment to be there, you know?
That season 2000. So he, let's see. Yeah. He'd won the first one back mm-hmm. in 2005, which was just awesome. I think that was, like, I think it was him, Valentino, and Colin Edwards were all on the podium or something, and it was just epic. And then 2006, that's when he won the world championship, and that race was he again Laguna Seca, but I think he won Assen in the Netherlands, and then the last race in Valencia was like a super dramatic, like. Him and Valentino, and mm-hmm. It's kind of a long story, but it's very, very emotional and exciting.
Yeah, I bet. And you had front row seat for this. So from there, from Road Racer X, you go to the Ducati?
Yeah, so that door opened up through Nicky. And, yep. I did have a good relationship with Ducati because, you know, from what I was saying before, mm-hmm. when I was, you know, working as a journalist in MotoGP and speaking Italian, they hired me to do that. And I did that for I was press officer for 3 years.
And then what's that like being, sorry, I interrupt you. I interrupt a lot, by the way, but, so you're American working in Italy and you speak Italian. Sure. But is that tough to do? Cause again, you need to speak all the languages and like how that, I imagine that would be a tough role.
It was tough, but not so much for those reasons. One of the reasons it was tough, it was a tough period for Ducati. Like right now,
they're crushing it now.
yeah. And they had actually won, I think it was in 2000, I can't remember, whenever Casey Stoner won. So they had some success with Casey Stoner, but then they fell off. So it was tough for that reason. It was also tough because it was when, it was 2011, 12, and 13. And so that when Valentino left Yamaha to come into Ducati and, you know, Ducati is in Italy, it's hard to describe how big of a brand Ducati is, but also how big of a brand Valentino is.
Yeah.
And so, and they both kind of have their hardcore passionate Italian enthusiast, you know, mm-hmm. Ducatisti, one, they even have a special name for him for Ducati.
Yeah.
And so those two entities kind of coming together was tough, especially given the fact that the environment was a losing environment.
Yeah, so the bike's just not the good, and then, you have everybody.
Yeah. But, I mean, It was also really exciting because like there nobody knew that it was going to be bad when he came in, when Valentino came in. So like the team had a bunch of sponsorship and stuff, and
He came to Yamaha a couple times. Valentino did. He seemed like a nice guy, mm-hmm. you know.
I
just was around people that were talking to him. He seemed like a really cool guy, and he was at the time, you know, the man, right?
Yep.
So
for sure, he was the man, and honestly, it was a tough. You know, I think it was a wake up call for him, and the bike was not good, but he was very professional through it all, and mm-hmm. and I rarely said a bad word. He lived up to his contract. It was a 2-year contract, and
yeah. And talking about Ducati, like I did a podcast with Antonio Caroli when he switched, and I know Antonio pretty well over the years, and I'm just like, why would you do this? Like he was team manager at KTM with Ducati, right, his old team, and he's just like, I'm Italian. Ducati, I live close to Ducati guys. I know them all. I've known them for years. This was, you know, this was like him going home. It was like a draw of like just the Italian motocross champion legend going to work for the legendary Italian company, right?
Like, it's just incredible. It's like Ferrari or something. You know? It was really cool to kind of be inside this world and.
And he just kept saying, "It's Ducati. It's Ducati. Why would I not go there?"
Yep. Exactly.
Did you? I love Europe. I love going to Europe. I love the history. Mm-hmm. I love walking down streets that, like, maybe World War II, the Germans were going down in tanks, and I love all that, Chris. And I love the history, and I, you know, love to soak it in. But also, I don't want to live there any more than like a week or two. I've had enough of it's not convenient. It's hard to drive. The beds aren't comfy. It's old school. Like all of these things that we're so used to as Americans. But you spent a lot of time in Europe. Did you love living there? Like, or did you yearn for the conveniences of America?
I mean, yes and yes. Both,
okay.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's you to live internationally. You can't expect things to be like they are back home, mm-hmm. and you have to embrace the new, you have to have an open mind.
Yeah.
You have to be curious.
Flexible. You gotta be flexible.
Yeah, be flexible for sure. And understand that yes, there are some nice things that you're not having that you're used to, but there's also some really cool things that you don't have back home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of which you alluded to. And I don't know, I just, by nature, I'm always kind of like my first day of kindergarten, my dad said when he took me to the bus stop, he was like worried I was going to start crying or something like that. And I said, okay, bye. You know, just like, got on the bus and I like experiencing cool things and new experiences and stuff. And, and I've been, you know, I've lived in, in addition to Italy and France, which I've already told you about, I lived in Mexico for like two years.
Oh wow!
And
what'd you do there?
This was during the 10-year off and on period with Cycle News.
Okay.
So two of those years were off, and I taught English and history at a middle school.
Oh, wow. You're so much more interesting than I thought, Chris. I knew you were interesting. Don't get me wrong. That's why I wanted to do this, but holy shit. Yeah.
Yeah. I like having those experiences. It's just, they're life altering. And
I know. I think it's so funny to me, and I've traveled so much, and I lived in Germany for 6 months back in the day trying to be a mechanic and all this stuff, and I've traveled to almost every country I've ever wanted to go to, and I just find the attitude of some Americans where this is a great country, there's so much opportunity, everything else, but I find the Americans, a lot of them, are just so close-minded to like how awesome other parts of the world is. Like, it kind of drives me nuts where I'm like, you know, they want to talk about America and being awesome. And it is. I'm not saying it is.
Totally.
But there's a lot of awesome countries, Sweden and Finland and Canada and Italy. You know, and I feel like some of the Americans are, because I think location, right? Obviously surrounded by water.
We're isolated. So it's much harder. If you're in Europe, you know, you can take a half hour plane ride and you're in a different country with a different language. And,
Yeah.
So I just think that it's,
sometimes I'm just like, man, you guys got to get out more. over here. You guys got to go to other cultures and other countries to experience what's awesome about them too, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like I told you when I went to Italy for a Cherubis for my internship, yeah, that I'd never even been on a plane before. That's why I count myself very fortunate that I had that opportunity to kind of fall in my lap.
Yeah.
And it showed me that, you know, I might not have ever, you know, had that opportunity to understand or realize that other places are cool too.
Yeah. It's sometimes it's like America is awesome, but that doesn't mean other countries aren't awesome also.
Exactly. There's some bad ones out there too.
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course. Right. But I'm just like, I'm yeah, befuddled sometimes by the attitudes of Americans. And this comes from a Canadian, right? I'm from Canada. I've lived here longer than I did in Canada, but sometimes I'm just like,
yeah,
man, you guys got to get out. There's awesome countries, yeah, all over the place, you know?
Yeah. No, it's absolutely.
So Ducati, you're there. Why do you come back home? How does that end? What's the plan there?
Well, it was awesome, but it was a lot of mainly travel.
Yeah.
Mainly the main thing. It was just like 3 years was the stint that I did. And like, I talked to you a little bit about how, you know, there's not as many MotoGP races as there are Moto and Supercross races, but yeah, each one is like a week long.
Yeah.
Almost, you know?
Yeah.
So you're gone. I had a young daughter, just felt like I was, you know, some people do that for years. Like there's like guys that have been in that paddock, mm-hmm, for, you know, decades. But, I had sort of done it. It was fun. I didn't really see where it was going to be going. So, I just let the contract expire after the third, mm-hmm, year, and kind of came back home and didn't really know what I was going to be doing.
Are you married at this point, and you're bringing the wife over?
Yeah.
So I
was
there.
Yeah, so my then wife is from Italy.
Oh,
actually.
Okay.
So I had,
wow,
met her during that first time that I was over there.
Yep.
My like I said, that's another thing. My daughter was getting ready to start kindergarten,
mm-hmm,
and so we were trying to decide, we kind of had to make a decision, right?
Yep.
Where's her path going to be? And,
yep,
we just decided, you know, like you said, US is a great country, and that's where we decided we want her to be,
okay,
going,
uh-huh,
to school. So,
yep,
not because we weren't happy in Italy, but just, I didn't really know what my future was going to be. And, so it just kind of made sense at the time. And, you know, this is my home, and I had kind of more to fall back on here, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of the context.
What's it like moving everything back from Europe, coming to America?
Yeah,
like,
it's tough. I had a bunch of stuff in storage, you,
okay,
know.
Yeah, yeah.
My apartment over there was furnished, my ex-wife's family, they could store some stuff in their garage and stuff, you know. So we could kind of take it, and she was going back and forth, you know, regularly, so we could take. We didn't have to do it all in one shot.
Right.
Basically.
Right. Okay. All right, awesome. So you come back and you start Johnham Media from there?
So there was a period where I was with a different agency.
Okay.
I didn't really have a whole lot of prospects, but I from my time as a journalist and everything, I knew a lot of people. And so I was introduced to a small agency that was in winter sports and bicycling. And they wanted to start power sports. So, mm-hmm, they brought me in to help with that. And, literally the same week that I joined them, I got a RFP from Honda, which they didn't even know that I had joined.
Oh, okay.
Request for proposal,
by the way, for RFP.
Yeah. 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 Which that I think had been sparked by, I was at a Long Beach trade show and talked to Lee Edmonds, who was the head of the PR department at the time.
Okay.
He didn't really, I just told him I was looking, so to keep an ear out for me, and didn't really expect it to be, an offer for me to pitch them for,
yeah,
being their agency.
Yeah.
Anyway, it worked out. We were able to, we presented to them, and, mm-hmm, were able to land that gig, and then, did that for 3 years, and then, just decided to start my own agency and do it on my own, do it without kind of just do it through myself.
I'm guessing with your experience with Road Racer X and with Ducati, it would be natural to come back to America and step into some road racing role. But, you know, obviously they sold it to DMG, AMA did. The series went through. I mean, when I was at Yamaha, motocross side was on one side. All the road race guys were on the other. So, like, Gobert and Jason DeSalvo and all these guys, I would, I got to know all the mechanics. I got to know the riders, the 600 class, the 1000 class. It was such a thriving series. It gets sold to DMG. It's a shell of its former self. Wayne Rainey's trying to, you know, build it back up into something, and I think he's doing an okay job from what Wygant says. But I'm guessing, Chris, there was nothing stateside in that kind of role, right?
Yeah, you know, I don't even know, to be honest. It's just basically this sort of it's you know, my career has sort of been a series of like one door closing and another one just happening to open up at the
same time.
So it's just it's not like some big plan that I have ever. I never knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. You know? It was just like these cool things sort of falling in my lap.
Right.
And just like, again, through that one conversation at this Long Beach motorcycle show, opened up this door to actually be, to create an agency to work for Honda, support Honda. And it's just, it was fortunate because it's a great job. It's also just fortunate because it really fit my background. You know, like I was able to leverage all these experiences and relationships that I had developed over the years. And I don't consider myself an entrepreneur. Like I never really planned to start my own company or anything like that, but it just sort of like, it was like, well, this is probably what I should do. This is probably the next step.
You're like, I'm good at it. Yeah.
And it just like the opportunity is there, you know, it's not often that you get to start a business with a very good chance of having a, client like Honda, you know, be the cornerstone of it. So it's just been, just a series of fortunate events.
What is the state of road racing in America? Like I said, Rainey's running it a little bit. DMG's got something to do with it. Is it getting better?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I'm not super involved in it now because, you know, with Honda, we don't have an in-house factory team. This year, we do have more involvement in it through some various, like, capable
support teams,
satellite support teams. And I think that's because that our renewed involvement in it, Honda's renewed involvement in it, is a sign that it is doing a lot better. But I don't think it's ever. I don't think it's still to the point where it was in the glory days. But it has. I think, you know, Wayne Rainey and his team have done a good job of building it back up and sort of understanding what it is, you know, and understanding like what it's not being overly ambitious and sort of building steadily and patiently.
Yeah. Again, I'm a sort of a historian of the sport. I've been reading Cycle News. It's crazy. You go through old Cycle Newses and this was, you know, the number one Bible for our sport, and routinely, not just once in a while, routinely, flat track and road racing would be bigger stories than the supercross or motocross race on the cover or just flipping through. Like it would be, you know, nowadays that's just nuts to think about. But back then, throughout the 90s, even it was, hey, this is what happened at Laguna Seca. This is what happened in Monza. This is what happened in Springfield. And then, Pontiac Silverdome. Here's the supercross race. Like that was just a normal thing.
No, you're right. It really was. And, you know, I do think supercross in particular and motocross too, though they really fit kind of the American mentality for some reason.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. A little rough around the edges, maybe
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Rough around the edges and just exciting and fast paced, you know, you know, road racing can be a little more, it's sort of like watching soccer. Sometimes maybe you have to be a little more educated about what it is that you're seeing, you know, to have an appreciation for it. Moto is just like, you get it right away. It just seems to kind of fit the American mentality. So yes, you're right. It was, road racing was much bigger back then, but I do think that it's pretty cool to see how moto has grown here in this country.
No, for sure. And I think McGrath had a lot to do with it, right? Jeremy comes along and he's such a personality and he's dominant. He's the Jordan or Tom Brady, you know, can he be beat? Will he be beat? Nobody can beat him. Right.
Exactly.
So I think that's a huge story and that really helped.
Yeah, and that was at Cycle News. I started in 92, so that was like right when McGrath was starting to come on. So I would sometimes like write my stories, like have them like 80% done before the race even happened, and then just go and change the lead.
McGrath pulled the whole shot. He led for the whole thing, and
exactly.
And LaRocco got a bad start.
Exactly.
Right. And, and you'd be done with it from there. Is there one moto race that stands out for you over the others? Was there one cool event? You mentioned MXDN in France, but was there a couple cool things that stood out for you?
As a journalist?
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably that MXDN, where that one was really cool. That was cool because, it's very memorable. It was obviously memorable for everybody. It was such a cool race, you know. And then it was memorable for me because I had going back to the how do you submit a story, you know. By then we had laptops, but the internet was not as available as it is now. And so like being 9 hours ahead, on Sunday night, I took advantage of that and said, I'm going to just wake up early and, you know, proofread my story one last time before I send it in.
Yeah.
And I talked to the press room at the track and they said, oh yeah, we'll be open tomorrow. So I went to the press room and it was open, but the internet was shut off.
Oh.
So it was like a holiday in France. So, I was like driving on these little farm roads, like trying to find internet cafes and stuff. And so ended up, like salon guy let me come in and give him my floppy disk and he sent the story to Paul, my boss.
Wow. Do you remember the days of like, hey, I got to enter the local area code, a number to get the dial up, you know, like,
yeah.
Oh,
party line, all that stuff.
Yeah. You're just like, okay, I'm in, you know, Dansville, Illinois. So now I got to dial up the
you
know, it's just,
The modem speed or dial-up modem speed and all that stuff. So going back to my the race that stands out.
Yeah.
It was probably not a motocross race. It was probably I got to cover the Dakar Rally.
Oh, okay.
In I think maybe 2002. So I think it was like just toward the end of my time at Cycle News.
Uh-huh.
And back when it was still in Africa, and that was just an amazing experience, you know, like going into Morocco and Mauritania.
Yeah, like Cycle News just expensed the whole thing. Just, hey, Chris, just go cover this thing for 2 weeks.
So it was kind of a weird deal where my past connections paid off, where Acherbies was a sponsor of the event, and they had, as part of their sponsorship deal, they had a spot on the press. They actually have a press plane.
Oh, okay.
They let me come and I was working for Cycle News and of course covered it for Cycle News. And, and by then we had internet. So I was also actually doing daily reports for Cycle News and stuff. But, I did freelance stories for Racer X and, bunch of Dirt Rider and, bunch of other magazines just to justify the expense to Acherbies. But, pretty much paid for by Acherbies.
Yeah, Shorty's obviously told me so many stories. Andrew Short's done that a bunch. And it sounds like, and again, he didn't do it through Africa, right? They rerouted it, but the stories are just insane. It's just nuts.
It's insane, dude. I literally had to sneak into Mauritania, which is one of the poorest. I think I'm probably the only person who's ever snuck into Mauritania because I couldn't get my stamp in time, my visa, in my passport, because the consulate in New York was like not open enough something.
Yeah.
So, there was like a little corrugated tin shack with like armed soldiers like standing around and stuff. And when the plane like landed in a lake bed and, they have like a temporary like customs thing set up and I just sort of tried to kind of do the Homer Simpson where you kind of try to fade into the shrubbery and kind of
be like, I'm with them. Yeah. I'm with all of them. Right.
Yeah. I just sort of walked around the shack instead of through the shack, you know?
Damn. Yeah. Yeah. That's a memory. All that covering the car probably was just nuts. So was that like Peter Hansel year? Like Stefan Peter Hansel was winning back then?
This was after Peter Hansel. So the winner was, it was Fabrizio Maioni, which was an Italian guy. And I think this was the first, he was on a KTM. It was the first year that the KTM twin, the 950 won.
So it was a big deal. So, yeah. Huge deal.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. What a career, Chris.
I know, dude.
What you're doing now must just be so goddamn boring. You're not sneaking into countries. You're not, going around the world. Yeah.
Yeah, as you know, running your own business, though, it's not boring. So
no.
It's got new adventures. And, you know, it's like I like I do like change and new stuff, you know? So I think it's if I were still doing the same thing, for me, it would become a little bit routine, even though it was really fun then, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah.
So I love what I'm doing. It's fun to work with these guys, you know, the riders and this company, you know, a company like Honda, and yeah. to get to have fun experiences and everything, and just try to make it all work. Try to make the field pay my employees and pay the bills.
Do you get some wanderlust sometimes where you're like, I got to get on the road?
I do. I mean, I do miss, I don't do as much, obviously, international travel anymore.
Right.
And I do miss that. I do a fair amount of travel, you know, I don't go to every race or anything like that, but mm-hmm. I go to maybe 8 or 10 races a year, do a fair amount of traveling for vacation.
Yeah.
Don't do as much of the international stuff, but
how many countries you've been to? You ever figured it out?
Dude, I don't know. When I was at Ducati, my passport, I had to get like an extension on my passport, like more yeah. pages added into
yeah.
it. So,
yeah. I can imagine.
I don't know. Yeah, it's a lot.
I bet. Jeez. Yeah, that's cool, man. I didn't even know. I didn't even know about the Mexico thing. So you dropped the bomb on me for that too. really cool, man. Really interesting career for sure. And congrats on the success of John and Media. Obviously,
Thank you guys
are doing a good job, as far as I can tell, at the races with the Honda guys. Look, you completely turned them around. It's all you guys. It's not Lars. It's not Brandon. It's all John and Media.
Well, yeah. Then you have to explain what happened to Ducati when I was there then.
Yeah, well, we can do that for sure. Well, listen, they used your experience to springboard them now where they can't be beat, right?
There you go. And actually, we had a few dry years when I first started, right? So
yeah. JT told me that Marquez got out of his deal to ride a year-old bike just to to get on them, and he told me the whole story, and now he's crushing it now. But like,
yeah, dude, they've done really well in the last few years, and Honda's trying to sort of build back up after a couple of lean mm-hmm. years.
Yamaha was good too with their Quintanaro guy, and then another.
Yeah.
I can't keep up with the series. That's part of the reason why I have a passing interest in F1 and I have no interest in MotoGP. I just don't like the sports where the machinery is everything. You know, I'm not a fan, where the engineers are deciding what's going on. And then at some point the series is like, well, let's take that advantage away and we're back to square one.
That is less the case in MotoGP than it is in F1, but it's mm-hmm. certainly more the case in MotoGP than it is in Moto.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's why I like Moto, where you can privateer, grab a bike and top 10 of moto or whatever, you know?
But can you get a whole shot?
Yeah. Well, no, that turns out it's mostly on the riders, I guess. Breaking news on that, man. Hey, thank you for the time on the Fly Racing Racer X podcast. Maybe this one will be one of the ones that Coombs listens to. I don't know. I'd love to get your journey down in audio for people. A really interesting guy, really interesting career. And again, thank you for the time, Chris. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate you having me on, and it was fun to kind of relive some of this stuff. I forgot about a lot of it.
Yeah, I bet. Cool, man. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Thank you.
See ya.
Bye.
This has been the Fly Racing Steve Mathis Show, presented by Maxxis Tires, Renthal, Motorsport.com, and Kuba Links on RacerXOnline.com. Thanks for listening and supporting our partners.